This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Late last week, having dispatched with Paris, attention in Washington quickly turned to Havana. That's where we'll focus for the rest of this hour. President Trump is reportedly considering reversing another milestone of the previous administration, relations with Cuba. Late in 2014, President Obama announced sweeping policy changes, including reestablishing diplomatic ties and easing travel restrictions. Here's Mr. Obama speaking in December of 2014.
The city of Miami is only 200 miles or so from Havana. Countless thousands of Cubans have come to Miami on planes and makeshift rafts, some with little but the shirt on their back and hope in their hearts. Todos somos Americanos. Change is hard, but today we are making these changes because it is the right thing to do. Today, America chooses to cut loose the shackles of the past so as to reach for a better future for the Cuban people, for the American people, for our entire hemisphere, and for the world.
Now, according to the New York Times and others, the Trump administration is looking at reinstating limits on travel and commerce. It cites human rights abuses by the Castro regime as justification for a harsher approach. Now, nothing's been finalized yet, not least of which because Mr. Trump faces deep disagreements within the administration over just how far to go in unwinding one of President Obama's big foreign policy achievements. The atmosphere this summer is a far cry from the mood in the Cuban capital a year ago. Last June, in Havana, some of Cuba's youngest musicians gathered in an old church in the dead of night to do something that used to be practically impossible. They recorded classical music with an American pianist. Simona Dinnerstein and the Havana Lyceum Orchestra began a journey that will lead them to tour the U.S. this summer together for the first time. It's a fitting encore for that superb performance on a hot Havana night. That is the second movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 in C major, performed by the Havana Lyceum Orchestra from the album Mozart in Havana. Earlier, Simona Dinnerstein joined us from NPR in New York to tell the story of how this unique musical relationship started.
I first met them when I went to Havana to participate in a piano festival there that my former teacher at the Manhattan School of Music, Solomon Mikofsky, had organized. He founded this piano festival, and he put me together with the orchestra to play a Mozart piano concerto. And I really didn't know what to expect, and got to the first rehearsal and was completely amazed by their playing and really just very moved by their playing. And I thought, oh, this is great, and it led to me wanting to record with them and bring them here to share with the U.S.
Do you know how the Havana Lyceum Orchestra came to be?
It was founded by their conductor, Jose Antonio Mendez Padron, and I think he founded it about 8 years ago with mainly students. So they're, at that time, I guess they were all in music conservatory. And now some of the younger members are still in conservatory. Some of them have graduated. But he's developed a kind of, I would say he's developed a musical identity to this orchestra. They have their own sound, which is really quite striking, very kind of burnished sound.
Describe these young people. You said that they're in conservatory. I'm assuming they're about college age, like late teens, early 20s, but talk about what walks of life they come from, how old they are. Describe them.
Yeah, so at this point, the ones in this orchestra, so it's actually an even larger orchestra. It's a symphony orchestra that they also condense it to be a chamber orchestra size, which is what I recorded with. And so in this configuration, all of them are over the age of 21. I know that because I've checked to see if they could drink. but yeah, they're all over the age of 21. And I would say that the majority of them are sort of between the ages of 21 and 25. And then there are some outliers that are a little bit older. And actually, some of their professors who are only in their 30s are also in the orchestra. They come from all over the island of Cuba, and by what I can gather, I mean, it's a little bit hard sometimes to completely get to the bottom of what a situation is there in Cuba, partially because I don't speak Spanish, and also there seem to be lots of different kinds of ways of talking about things in Cuba that are somewhat mysterious. So I think that basically they come from very diverse backgrounds. Some of them came from very limited means, and they all were brought to Havana to study at the conservatory. And they, you know, everything is paid for them, so they have instruments and they study, but the instruments that they're working with are, you know, often really not the best instruments.
Talk about this night in the church. It all sounds very spooky and mysterious. Why did you go to this old church and record in the dead of night?
Well, there's no recording studio in Havana that's large enough for an orchestra, so we had to use a church, and this church is frequently used for recording. However, there's really no sound insulation from the street, and Havana is quite a noisy city. So we had to wait until the middle of the night. In fact, we had to wait until after a certain time because every night there's a soap opera that is on TV, I think at 10, and most people watch it. So you're going to hear it coming from all of the apartment buildings around you.
When everybody's favorite telenovela comes on, everything stops and gets loud all
it
at
stops.
Once.
Yeah, yeah, that's the priority. So we started recording at 11 p.m. and we would record until 3 a.m. and we did that for three nights.
I know how my brain can begin to wander from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. How did you and these young people keep it together from 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. to get this album done?
You know, I was quite worried about that because it was also very hot. You know, we had to turn the air conditioning off as well because we couldn't have the noise of the air conditioning. They were remarkably focused. I was so impressed. I mean, even in the breaks that we would take, they would want to go into the producer's booth to listen to playbacks. And they just wanted to keep on getting better. And I just wanted to sit down and rest.
How much of that focus do you think was maybe connected to a sense of what the recording could mean for them? I mean, did they know that doing this recording well could open a door to the United States or beyond?
You know, you're the first person to have ever said that. And to be honest, that's oddly never occurred to me. I mean, I think that that could be a good point. I assumed that they had a really strong work ethic and that they, just because of the way that they played, when I heard them, even without me, like in concert, when I heard them play without me, there is a very high standard. And so I was just thinking about it in a very kind of simple, purely musical ideal, that they wanted it to be as good as possible. But you're right, it probably has also occurred to them that it will raise awareness about them in the rest of the world if they have a really good recording.
The way that you describe that musicality and the way that they play and interface with you is something that we heard kind of echoed by your producer, Adam Abeshaus, who's a Grammy Award winner and the man who kind of brought the sound together for the album. This is one of the takeaways he had from one of the recording sessions you had in the church.
To me, there's this great conversation that goes on. Simona might play a phrase and the wind's played back at her. And you get this great three-dimensional perspective. So the flute has this beautiful glow around this, her sound. And what is so beautiful is that you hear this phrase, this liquid running phrase that Simona plays, and then you hear it come back orchestrated through the flute, which is kind of similar to what's, you know, going on in the world now. You know, we're all trying to talk to each other. We're trying to hopefully let the U.S. and Cuba come together. And I think of these kind of moments in the music as art representing life.
Simona Dinnerstein, how much of that musical interface did you notice? Did it kind of click? Was it natural? Did you have to work at finding a rhythm with these young people? How did that work?
It was very natural and actually highly unusual to click that quickly with a group of musicians, especially since we couldn't really talk to each other. I mean, the conductor, Jose, he speaks English, so he would translate if I said something. But the thing that was so striking about this group of musicians was how much they listened while they played. And this is something that I think non-musicians don't realize, how listening is almost as important, if not more important, than how you play, because you have to be able to respond. And especially in a piece like this, it's not even just the orchestra responding to me, it's individual instruments within the orchestra responding both to me and to each other. And the only way that that can happen is if, you know, like a jazz musician, you're just open to any little event that might take place in the moment.
Now, explain that a little bit more. I mean, I think people maybe who are not familiar with musical performance might look at it as just notes on a page. Mozart wrote it. You play it the way that he wrote it. Kaboom. That's it. But you're talking about more of a, it feels almost like call and response. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
It's actually very much like call and response, and that is how Mozart wrote it, in that he'll have a passage, a musical passage played by one instrument and then either copied by another instrument or taken to another level by that other instrument, varied in some way. And as interpreters, we have to bring it to life. I mean, the notes that Mozart wrote are meaningless without us playing them. It needs to come to life. And so being an interpreter is a search for what is important in the music, what's interesting, what's vital, what do we want to show in this particular performance that we've discovered in Mozart's music. And of course, there are a million ways you could respond to those notes on the page. And it just so happened in this case that the orchestra was really extremely compatible with me, and that we had a very similar approach to it, so that I could throw them a curveball and then they could throw me a curveball, and we knew how to catch them. It was really exciting.
We're speaking to classical pianist Simona Dinnerstein about her experiences performing with the Havana Lyceum Orchestra. They'll be touring the U.S. this summer together for the first time. I understand that you brought over some strings for the orchestra. Why was that?
Yeah, so when I first performed with them in 2015, I noticed that they tuned extremely low. So That means that basically they were making their A, they were making all of their sounds very flat. And the reason why they were doing that was because they couldn't afford to buy new strings. And the more taut the strings are, the sharper the strings are, the more likely they are to break. And it was quite striking how low it was. And the conductor told me that even some of them were even using telephone wire for some of their E strings because they just couldn't afford them. And I couldn't believe that they were making such an incredible sound using those strings. So I talked about it. After I did that concert, I came back and I was actually interviewed on Morning Edition, and I spoke about this problem with the strings, and many people wrote to me and asked if they could donate strings. And so when it came time to go down and record with the orchestra, I contacted some of the people that had talked to me, and two of them bought all new strings and all new reeds for the orchestra.
That's fantastic. But at the same time, I wonder if maybe that represents a real adjustment for these young people that maybe they're not quite ready for. I mean, I grew up learning to play piano badly, but I learned how to play on a piano that was entirely out of tune. Every key was a half step flat. So when I grew up and studied music, I had to remember that what I heard in my head as C was actually B, and everything in my brain was a half step off. How did these young people adjust to having more support, more attention, more resources? Did they take to it, or did they have to really relearn music all over again?
Well, that's a very interesting point. And by the way, you must have perfect pitch then, if you were noticing that years later.
I figured it out eventually. Sooner or later, I got it. Yeah.
But actually, with this orchestra, they just blossomed into the new strings. It was really, they're such good musicians. I mean, they're so skilled that they, it just helped them sound even better.
We'll continue our conversation with Simona Dinnerstein in just a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with American classical pianist Simona Dinnerstein and the Havana Lyceum Orchestra. As we mentioned, the orchestra's plans to tour the U.S. this summer could be a one-off, since some in the Trump administration are considering reinstating travel restrictions between America and Cuba. More on that in a moment, but first let's get back to our conversation, which, by the way, we recorded before these latest reports about the administration came to light. How much do the politics between the United States and Cuba factor into your work with the Havana Lyceum Orchestra? Relations between the two countries have slowly been opening up and opening up more under the Obama administration, including the end of the wet foot, dry foot rule, the renormalization of relations. That's not entirely popular with some in, say, South Florida's Cuban exile community. And I know that some performances by Cuban artists and Cuban musicians in the U.S. have been met with strident protests from the Cuban exile community. How much, if at all, did all of that politics affect your work with these young people?
It did hold up our recording process because we had to delay by several months because we couldn't obtain the correct license in time. But mainly, I would say, I've been very, very involved in organizing the concerts for this tour. And I spoke to a lot of concert promoters in the United States to see if they would be interested in presenting this orchestra. And I think that mainly the thing that came up was that people were worried that they would book the orchestra and then the orchestra wouldn't be allowed to come. And I'm still on tenterhooks about that. But I'm, you know, just hoping for the best that it's all going to work out. And that's been the most sort of scary part of the politics for me, is just them having the visas to come.
Have you heard anything from the State Department that would lead you to believe they would not be able to get in, or are you still kind of in wait and see mode?
Well, we're in wait and see mode now until they all have their interviews. I met with the State Department when I was there recording, and they said that, of course, it's you know, it's a higher risk when young people come. It's a lower risk if people that are married and have families in Cuba come over to perform, because they're more likely to go home. But I think that also this policy that just was changed, whereby if you were a Cuban and you stayed illegally in the United States for a year, you would automatically become a U.S. citizen. That policy, Obama changed shortly before he left office. And I have a feeling that that also will actually make it easier for the orchestra to come here.
What's your read on how all these young people are taking this opportunity to come tour the U.S.? Are they excited? Are they nervous? Are they scared? Are they blasé about it?
I think they're very excited. I'm actually about to go to Havana to rehearse with them for the tour, and I'm very curious to talk with them and describe what they have in store for them here. They're going to be really thrown into American society, because when they arrive, all 41 of them are staying with families in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Wow.
I found them all homes in my neighborhood. That's where I live. And my husband teaches at the local public school there. And most of the families are families from that school. And I think it's going to be so much better than them staying in hotels for that first week, because they'll get to know what it's like to, you know, really be in an American home. Of course, it's a Brooklyn home. That's not really representative of, all of America.
But Park Slope's not bad. If you got to get stuck in New York, there's worse places to get stuck.
Yeah, I think it's a nice place.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, every night there's another barbecue or dinner for the whole orchestra. And it's going to be really great. So, I mean, I think that we're traveling all the way from Boston to Miami, where all the concerts are on the East Coast, and they'll get to see New England. They'll see, you know, Philadelphia. They'll see Washington, D.C. and Miami. And I think it's really nice that they're going to see different parts of the United States.
So those are the four dates: Boston, Philly, Miami. Could you run through the tour?
Yeah, it's actually 9 dates. The first is Boston, then Worcester, Massachusetts, then Central Park in New York, then Fairfax, Virginia, Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania, which is the one of the DuPont estate, then the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, then Miami, the New World Symphony, and then we finish in College Park, Maryland, with the National Orchestral Institute.
When these young people are done with this tour and they go back to their lives in Havana, what do you want them to take with them of this experience?
I really hope that, I mean, I feel confident about it, but I also hope that they'll come back thinking that America welcomed them and appreciated them and was inspired by them. I think that they should realize how extremely special they are. And that's why I wanted to bring them here, is because I wanted them to inspire us, and for them to feel that they are noticed and that they mean something to us here. So I hope that that's what they come back feeling, and that they're, you know, that they have felt like they experienced sort of the best of America, the, you know, the diversity. We're going to go to different schools, public schools along the way, and work with kids. And I think they'll be surprised by what they see here. I'm guessing that they're going to have preconceptions that everybody here is pretty well off. And I have a feeling that when we go into some of these public schools, they're going to be, they're going to be taken aback by what they see.
And finally, what do you hope to take away from this tour? What's your goal for this tour, not just as a musician, but as a person in the middle of this experience?
Well, for me, this is really, I have to say, this is one of the most exciting things I've ever done in my life. And it's because it brings together something that I feel very strongly about artistically, playing with this orchestra and the music that we make together, with something that is very important to me, which is communication between people, between cultures, sort of getting past economic boundaries. I think that classical music can be very elitist, and it shouldn't be. And for me, this symbolizes all of those things, and I feel honored to be part of this.
One more question, actually. You've been teaching the orchestra a great deal. What have they taught you? Is there anything you've learned from them in all of this?
Oh, yes. I mean, well, they have an even stronger work ethic than I do in terms of searching for perfection. They never were able to take anything for granted. There's so much that I've taken for granted, and it made me realize that. Just even hearing about how much money they make per month as musicians compared to how much money I make per month, and the fact that they keep on working as hard as they can on that, I think that's really the way that people should live. Is, you know, you live to do something meaningful because it gives meaning to your life, not for the material side effects of doing your job.
That's classical pianist Simona Dinnerstein. She'll be touring this summer with the Havana Lyceum Orchestra. Simona, break a leg, and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
You'll find more about the orchestra and their upcoming tour on our website, the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. Let's spend the rest of this hour talking about where policy with Cuba stands today and pick up on those reports that the Trump administration is close to announcing new policies. Here's a quote from White House spokesman Michael Short. Quote, "As the president has said, the current Cuba policy is a bad deal. It does not do enough to support human rights in Cuba. We anticipate an announcement in the coming weeks." Unquote. That is from White House spokesman Michael Short. Let's discuss it further with NPR's Tom Gelton. He has reported extensively from Cuba. His books include Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause, and A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Tom Gelton, welcome to 1A.
Great to see you, Joshua.
Remind us where Cuba policy sat at the end of the Obama administration, beginning of the Trump administration. Clearly, it seemed like things were opening up a great deal.
They certainly were, Joshua. There are limits because the embargo against Cuba was an act of law, which means only Congress can overturn it. But President Obama did everything he could as president through executive orders and other executive actions to loosen that policy. And what the bottom line was that the most important thing, Americans were much more free to travel to Cuba, even on their own. Previously, you had to go as part of a group, a charter group, something like that. Under the changes that President Obama announced in December of 2014, individual Americans could go to Cuba, and when they returned, they simply had to self-certify that they were going for one of 12 identified legitimate reasons. They didn't have to go as part of a group. So this really opened the door to travel to Cuba, and along with it, U.S. airlines and U.S. cruise lines were given the freedom to organize, to fly or to sail directly to Cuba. So big changes in the travel department.
It seems like a lot of the changes that happened, and we'll get to President Trump's possible changes in a moment. It seemed like a lot of the changes that happened had to do with commerce, with allowing people to travel, with allowing businesses to do business, maybe allowing banks to make wire transfers or internet companies to provide broadband, as opposed to going the human rights route.
Well, they justified these moves on the grounds that the more engagement with Cuba, the more Cuba would moderate and loosen its hold on the Cuban people. That has been that has not turned out to be the case. It's pretty clear. We just recently saw a report from the Cuban Commission on Human Rights saying that the number of political prisoners in Cuba is twice what it was last year. The Cuban government actually has, mixed feelings about these changes. On the one hand, it's benefiting financially because it gets, basically the Cuban government owns most of the tourism facilities, so they benefit from that. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that they're nervous about this increased engagement with the United States. And one clear sign of that, Joshua, was on the 1st of May, which is always a big holiday in Cuba, Labor Day. And there was a Cuban who ran up in front of the stage where Raul Castro was speaking, waving a U.S. flag. That's all he did. He ran in front, waving a U.S. flag.
Wow.
He has since been arrested and sent to a psychiatric hospital. So clearly, the Cuban authorities aren't all that comfortable about the Cuban people really embracing America.
How much do we know about what the Trump administration might do? Is this all tentative at this point, or have there been any hints of what policy might look like?
Well, there are a couple things that could happen concretely. One is that always with respect to travel to Cuba, a lot depends on how rigorously the restrictions are enforced. And right now, a message went out basically to border authorities not to enforce even those few restrictions that were still in place. So the Trump administration could and probably would send out the opposite signal. Let's start enforcing the regulations that remain in place. That would be a big thing. They could also reinstitute the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy, which means that Cubans who were fleeing Cuba, once they arrived in the United States, were able to put their foot down on dry soil, they'd be allowed to stay. The Trump administration could reinstate that as well.
We're speaking briefly to NPR's Tom Gelton about where policy from the United States towards Cuba stands today. We did get a few questions about this, including about what the laws might look like for this today on the legislative side, not just on the executive side. Kat tweeted us, how does the Senate bipartisan bill called the Freedom to Travel to Cuba Act impact White House policy? A majority of senators are in favor of it. What is the Freedom to Travel to Cuba Act, and does it have majority bipartisan support, Tom?
It absolutely does in the Senate. It's not clear that it does in the House. It has 55 U.S. senators, Republicans and Democrats alike, in the Senate supporting this, which would end basically all travel restrictions to Cuba of all kinds. So do away even with those few restrictions that were still in place at the time President Obama left office. And the truth is that ending travel restrictions to Cuba has for years actually had majority support in the Senate and probably in Congress as a whole. It's just that it has never been strong enough to sort of overcome the threat of a veto, or maybe some members of Congress aren't willing to really fight for it. In theory, they're for it. But the number of members of Congress who are supporting this has steadily increased. 55 is the most who have ever supported it in the Senate.
I know our time is low, but I wonder about that statement from White House spokesman Michael Short when he said that, according to the president, the current Cuba policy does not do enough to support human rights in Cuba. Now, the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, has said that there's a difference between American values and American foreign policy. So the administration's kind of made it clear that there's some daylight there. What do we read into the president's motivations for wanting to change policy toward Cuba, briefly?
Well, human rights have not increased, have not improved in Cuba since the announcement of this policy. In many ways, they have actually sort of slid backwards. Now, the advocates say that there are other reasons besides human rights. There's, first of all, the freedom to travel. Americans want to don't like the government telling them where they can go, where they can't go. And there's a big economic incentive for it. I mean, there was a recent report that came out that said thousands of jobs would be lost in the travel industry if these travel restrictions were put back in place. So there are other arguments for doing this besides the human rights argument. It doesn't hinge completely on that. Now, there is one other issue, and that's Venezuela. Cubans are supporting Venezuela, the government of Maduro, and that could be a problem as well.
And what about the Cuban government? How is the Castro regime holding up these days, briefly?
They're still in power. I mean, Raul Castro has to give up power next year in 2018. The U.S. Director of National Intelligence just came out with a report saying that the holding on to power remains the Cuban authorities' number one priority above everything else.
Yeah. Well, he's supposed to let go of power in 2018.
He's supposed to.
Exactly. We'll see if that happens. That's NPR's Tom Gelton, the author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the Biography of a Cause. Tom, thanks for talking to us.
Great to be here, Joshua.
Thanks for taking us with you over the weekend. And we hope that you will subscribe to 1A's podcast. You can take us with you wherever you go, whenever you like, on the NPR One app, iTunes, or whatever app you like. You'll find more great podcasts at npr.org/podcasts. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.